This episode is brought to you by The Profit Line. Now, hopefully you guys recognize that I'm quite selective about the sponsors that I choose to partner with, but The Profit Line might just be in a league of its own, given that I was a customer of theirs for 7 consecutive years while running my own company. The Profit Line is a boutique finance and accounting firm that provides a wide range of accounting services to small and medium-sized businesses, generating anywhere between $5 to $50 million in revenue or so. On a fractional outsource basis, they will do all of your bookkeeping, bank reconciliations, month-end accruals, tax compliance, financial statement preparation, and they'll work hand-in-hand with your auditors, among countless other things. When I purchased my business, I noticed that the books were a total mess. The company's accounting wasn't compliant with GAAP, they were overly complex, and they just didn't work for the company's new reality, which suddenly included auditors, a bank, investors, and a board. Because of this, I brought in The Profit Line within my first month or so as a CEO. And fast forward to 7 years later, they were still there to help us get our books ready for an exit. We used them when we had no finance and accounting department to speak of, and continued to work with them even as we grew our finance team to 4 people, including a CFO. For those of you currently running a business, visit theprofitline.com to learn more about how they may be able to help you. For those of you currently evaluating a target to acquire, The Profit Line also offers a high-level, affordable overview of a target company's current accounting systems, processes, and environment. This analysis can be used in conjunction with your QOV project, or it can be done in advance of it to ensure that there are no large red flags before you start spending the big bucks. Again, that's theprofitline.com. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of In the Trenches. I am your host, Steve DeVitkos. Today's episode is one that I've been trying to arrange for a very long time now, and as a result, I am very excited to be presenting it to you. For those of you who do not know, Constellation Software is one of the world's most admired, well-followed, and well-respected software acquirers. Since their founding in 1995, they have acquired over 500 individual software companies and employ an infinite hold period. Said another way, their model is explicitly never to sell any portfolio company. And the size and makeup of the companies that they typically target is highly relevant to our audience, given that they typically target companies generating somewhere between $3 to $10 million in revenue, which often employ somewhere between 50 to 200 people. The shareholder letters written by Constellation's founder and CEO, Mark Leonard, are seen as must-reads and have grown to achieve Buffett or Bezos-like status among those of us in the software investing community. Joining me today is Mike Dufton, CEO of the Valaris Group, which is one of the 6 major operating units underneath the Constellation Software umbrella. Under Valaris alone, as CEO, Mike oversees over 200 individual operating companies spanning 50 countries and 40 vertical markets. Prior to joining Constellation over a decade ago, Mike was the CEO or president of 4 different enterprise software companies, again spanning multiple verticals. For anybody who has ever considered acquiring a software company, there is a treasure trove of information to be gleaned from today's episode. So I hope that you enjoy listening to it as much as I enjoyed putting it together for you. I will conclude, as always, by mentioning that I am an active investor in search funds and the companies they acquire. So if you have your own target in sights, whether it's a software company or not, I'd love to hear from you. And now on to today's episode with Mike Dufton. Mike Dufton, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much, Steve. Well, happy to be here.
Well, it's nice to have you here. And I have a lot of questions as a someone who's been following Constellation Software's progress from the sidelines for many years. But before we get there, just to kind of set the table and set the context, can you maybe start by telling us a bit more about yourself and the arc of your career and what has led you to what you are doing today?
Sure. That's a great question. So my name's Mike Dufton, and I've been in the technology industry my entire career. And I would say a large part of my career was spent in the financial services industry. So I've led three different businesses that all had a connection to financial services technology in some way, shape, or form. Spent about 15 years of my career, initially as a salesperson, and then ultimately becoming the CEO of the business of a company that was called Solcorp, that was a leading supplier of ERP systems to the life insurance industry. And during that period of time, I had the incredible opportunity to watch a Canadian business go from a strong player in Canada to one of the leading players on a global scale, with a lot of expansion in the US, in Europe, and especially in Asia Pacific, where we actually had a very large growth opportunity in the Japanese market. From there, I left and I went to a software as a service business. I really wanted to learn more about the software as a service industry. So I went into a business called IntelliResponse, which was a machine learning type of solution in the very early days. And really what it was a self-servant agent that enabled you to ask questions and get literal responses, as opposed to doing a search, as we would have known back in those days, of going onto Google and looking at things. And that was a business that did quite well. Ultimately was, I left that business and I went to a third company called Majesco MasTech, which was a business based out of New York, but it was essentially the North American division of a Indian outsourcing business. And I led that business for a few years and continued to grow the business in the US, and ultimately opened a Canadian operation for it as well, and built a base of customers in Canada also. So that was kind of my career prior to coming to Constellation Software. And I joined Constellation over a decade ago, rather fortuitously, from a conversation I'd had with a gentleman named Mark Miller, who has been the CEO of Valaris for quite some time and is now the chairman of Valaris, as I've recently taken over as the CEO. And Mark and I knew each other thanks to an organization called Ace Tech. We were both big believers in sharing knowledge across CEOs, learning from each other. And I'd say that's really what brought me to Constellation. Constellation being a company that really believes in the value of developing talent, building out people, and sharing best practices in terms of what we've learned. So I joined the business over a decade ago, really with the intention of building out a financial services portfolio of companies, which is one of the things I've done since I got here.
Fantastic. And you mentioned that you are the CEO of Valaris. Just briefly, can you remind folks listening how Constellation is organized into various business units, and including how many individual software companies reside under the Valaris umbrella today?
Sure. So the Constellation, I guess maybe just a little bit of background on Constellation, since some of your listeners may not be familiar with who we are. So Constellation Software is a company that over the years has acquired hundreds, really probably thousands of software enterprises now. And really the focus has always been acquiring businesses and then helping them to learn from our best practices and strengthening out the enterprise. So Constellation as a whole is obviously a multi-billion dollar corporation, with businesses all over the world. Valaris itself is one of six operating groups of Constellation Software. So each of the operating groups tends to focus in certain verticals, or if you want, industry-specific segments. And so Valaris would be one of those six operating units. Inside Valaris itself resides over 200 software businesses.
Fantastic. Okay. So what's really interesting about your background is that you have run several vertical software businesses, and now you're in the business of acquiring many vertical and horizontal software companies as well. So you're the CEO of Valaris, which encapsulates 200 individual software companies. Can you give us just and I'm sure the answer is it depends and there's a wide range, but just to give us some context, the average or typical acquisition, if there is such a thing, in terms of revenue, EBITDA, number of employees, just to put some size parameters around the types of companies you guys are buying?
Sure. So they, you know, that number obviously changes on an annual basis, but I would say in general, if you think about the sweet spot of the types of acquisitions that we do, it's probably somewhere between $3 and $10 million in revenue. A typical employee base size is probably between 50 and 200 employees would be the normal size of enterprise that we're acquiring. And as I said earlier, you know, we started out obviously in Canada as a Canadian business, but now the revenues are extremely diversified. So those acquisitions really could be almost anywhere in the world. So it's a very diversified portfolio of businesses that you have.
Fantastic. Okay. So given that Constellation is in the business of acquiring other software businesses, can you just clarify for our listeners who may not be familiar, what differentiates Constellation from, say, a software-focused private equity firm who is also in the business of acquiring software businesses?
Yeah, I mean, there's probably a couple of things. I mean, obviously we have similarities, but I'd say probably the most stark difference between ourselves and most other acquirers out there in whatever form they are is that we are a buy and hold forever enterprise in the sense that we do not sell our investments. And most private equity firms have a hold period where they're focused on, and there's always an expectation of a subsequent exit. So I think there are many other things we do in terms of developing talent that are probably unique to us, but I'd say the most obvious difference between ourselves and other acquirers is that we hold on to all of the companies we acquire for life. And I think that really measures itself most significantly in the way that we work with the leadership of that business, because whatever we do post-acquisition, it's always with the mindset of we're going to be working together for decades. So we need to be doing whatever is in the best long-term interest of the businesses we acquire. And I think that longevity means that we have the time to get the relationships right with our customers to ensure that we can maintain a lifelong relationship with them as well.
Fantastic. Okay. So I think the table is set. We are talking to somebody who is the CEO of Valaris, who owns 200 small and medium sized software businesses. That falls underneath the umbrella of Constellation, which owns thousands of small and medium sized software companies. In addition to that, you've had leading operating roles in three software companies. So I have a lot of questions for you. Folks, regular listeners of this podcast will know that I ran my own software company. But there is also a lot of people listening to this, Mike, who themselves are interested in acquiring a software company, many of whom are non-technical CEOs, as I was 10 plus years ago. So we're going to divide our conversation today in two buckets, buying a software company and then running a software company. And let's start with buying, because obviously that's what has to come first, at least for the acquisition entrepreneurs listening to this. And where I actually want to start, Mike, is a question that has nothing to do with financials and instead is entirely product related. Mm-hmm. After having run my software company for many years, I came to appreciate at a very deep level the importance of technical debt. So when you guys as Constellation are evaluating a new software company to buy, how do you understand the level of technical debt that might reside within the code base? And maybe to begin with, can you just define what technical debt even means?
Well, I guess technical debt would be, I guess I would think of it in the manner of technology as a continuing evolving landscape. So as time progresses, we need to be cognizant that there are shifts in preferences around programming languages, around the underlying data structures of that business, how essentially flexible is the application, how important is the use of APIs for exchanging information with other applications. So I would say I think of technical debt as how hardwired is the application? How flexible is it for the future? And how does it adapt to a changing landscape where new entrants are coming into the marketplace all the time? And the customers of any technology want to know that the application is going to be flexible enough to coexist with their evolving technology landscape. Is that a reasonable way of phrasing technical debt?
100%. And I guess that the logical follow-up question is, how do you go about figuring out how much technical debt you might be acquiring?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I mean, I don't think that's an easy one to answer because you need to obviously also have a crystal ball to understand where technology is going to be going in the future. So I would say what we tend to do is we would bring in our product experts, if you like, to sit down, review the applications that the company is currently selling. We'd obviously have one-on-one meetings with the CTO of that business to understand how do they see it. And we would look at, how many new customers the business has been acquiring. So if we find a business where they haven't had any new customer acquisitions, we would come to the conclusion that there may be a higher likelihood that there is some technical debt that hasn't been addressed because new customer win rates are lower. It's not always the case, but that could be one of the reasons. But I'd say most of the time what we're looking at is reviewing the code base, talking to the technologists themselves, and then comparing, how we see that solution and that marketplace evolving. So it's I would say it's a lot of discussions. There is a technical code review that typically happens, but I would say a lot of it is by looking at the underlying metrics of the business. So asking questions and then seeing how customers are responding, because customers are usually a pretty good indicator of how they view the progressiveness of the code base.
So this question is so high level, it might even be useless, but I'll float it out there anyways. I'm trying to figure out, like, how important is the technical debt discussion in the overall investment thesis? So is it like page one of every investment memo, or is it kind of buried in every investment memo somewhere as just kind of an inescapable reality of buying a 20-year-old software company?
Yeah, I would say it's not page one. It's part of the conversation, but it's not the most important part of the conversation. I think what's going to drive the discussion more than the level of technical debt is the stickiness of the customer relationships themselves. Because if you have strong, long-standing relationships with clients, the clients are also sharing in the importance of the need to address whatever technical debt exists inside a business. So if there is technical debt, and to your point, there's always going to be some form of technical debt, even in a 5-year-old business, let alone a 20-year-old business. It's a question of, will the customers come on the journey with you? Will they help you to shape their views on how the technical debt should be addressed? Because inherently, clients don't like change. So if we do a full-scale rewrite of a core application, it's quite likely we will upset as many of our customers as we do, delight our clients. Because, to each individual customer, technical debt is a theoretical construct. It's a concern they would have, but it's not usually what they wake up worrying about every single day, right? And I think sometimes as software individuals, we lose sight of that. Particularly if we're working in the development organization, we want to be the latest and greatest. We always want to have the most current technology. It's great for our resume. It's great for developing the talent that works inside of us. But to customers, it's what's much more important is the depth of capability that the application actually provides. So I would say their number one priority is, does the software do the functions we most need it to? And probably further down on their list as well is how modern is the technology.
Right. So correct me if I'm wrong. It kind of sounds like what I'm hearing is the customers are effectively voting just how problematic the technical debt may or may not be. And they are voting, I guess evidence of that voting manifests through new customer acquisition numbers and existing customer retention numbers. And so long as both of those are, good or satisfactory or great or whatever they may be, then almost by definition, we're seeing that the technical debt is at a quote unquote acceptable level. Is that like a reasonable summary?
Yeah, I think that's a fair way of looking at it. I think, technical debt is something that's addressed over years, not months.
Right.
So as a long-term investor, you presume that there's always going to be technical debt that's part of the solution that needs to be solved for. And I guess what I'm suggesting is we believe very strongly in the value of long-term customer relationships. So it's a conversation that needs to be held with the customers, not, you know, given to the customers, here's your solution. So right. I think customers are typically quite willing to engage in a dialogue with any software provider. And if you've got a strong relationship, they'll be a wonderful partner to help you address the technical debt.
Yeah, fascinating. I feel like I could do an entire episode with you just about technical debt, but I think my episodes can be boring enough as it is. So let's move on to other questions vis-a-vis buying these small software companies. And Mike, I'm going to ask you a question that I already know is unfair, but if you'll indulge me, if we lived in a theoretical world and you were only ever allowed to see three metrics to help you evaluate whether you should make an investment, what might those three metrics be and why?
Sure. Well, that would be interesting. I guess probably, you know, one thing that would be critical is the level of attrition that exists inside the business. So, you know, I think when we're thinking as long-term investors, we want to know that the clients see value in the customer relationship and that in general, customers are staying with the software business for extended periods of time. So I think for us, again, we focus a lot on the importance of clients and the importance of doing right by those customers. So attrition would be a very meaningful metric that we would focus on. I guess if I only had three metrics and I needed to evaluate whether I wanted to make the business, once I looked at attrition, I'd want to understand the level of growth inside the enterprise. So is this a growing business? And of course, inside that, you'd want to understand what's driving that growth, but growth would be another metric that would be important to me. And then last would probably be just the size of the enterprise itself. So I guess a revenue metric. And leading to your follow-on question, why am I not looking at profitability as one of those three key metrics? I think profitability is a manageable number. And if you've addressed attrition and if you've addressed growth and you have a good sense of what that looks like, and you have a sense of the relative size of the business, you can pretty much map out how you'll drive profitability in the enterprise over the longer term. So that's why I didn't select profit as one of the things I would look at.
Sure, sure. And I'm not at all surprised to hear you say retention. In fact, that would certainly be number one on my own list of three. If I could double click on retention though, and I know this is already an unfair question, so I'll ask you an even more unfair follow-up question. Sometimes logo retention and revenue retention tell the same story, and sometimes they tell somewhat divergent stories. So in an even more unfair hypothetical world, if you could only look at logo retention, which is what percentage of last year's customers are still customers this year, or revenue retention, which is what percentage of last year's revenue dollars are still revenue dollars this year, which one might you look at? And I get that it's a totally unfair question. You want to look at both.
Yeah, I would. What I would say is it really depends on the nature of the business, right? So if this is a SaaS business with a large and very diversified customer base, I'm probably going to be trying to understand logo retention. If it's a more traditional enterprise level software business, I'm probably much more interested in understanding revenue retention because I've probably got a smaller number of customers that I'm looking at already, right? So I of course you'd want to look at both, but I think it's a question of what's the investment premise built on. Is this we're managing the existing client relationships, we're continuing to grow at a reasonable pace, or is this a business that we think is more of a land grab where we think we've entered into a newer market? It's a relatively unproven market now, and in that case we obviously want to understand how well is the business able to retain its existing logos, right? So are they delivering on the promises that they offer to their customers?
Right, right. And is one of the reasons why you look at revenue retention in smaller businesses is because when one unit attrits out of, I don't know, 30 customers, then maybe it's asymmetrically affecting churn?
It would be. I suppose that's true. I guess I would say just more you know, it's important to understand what's happening in the revenue of each of the customers themselves, right?
Right.
So, you know, I would say as a company that acquires many, many software businesses, we look very heavily at the operating metrics of the existing business and a lot of the data, and we'll spend a significant amount of time looking at those customer relationships and trying to understand every element of what causes them to churn, what causes them to grow, what causes them to churn in certain areas and grow in other areas. Like, you know, it's going to be a lot of detail understanding those existing customers. And that's true of any Constellation operating division. We care deeply about the existing clients.
Yep. Okay. So we've talked about growth and we've talked about profitability. Let's combine those two considerations and talk about the rule of 40. So for those who might be, mm-hmm. might not be aware, rule of 40 is just the percentage growth rate of revenue plus the percentage EBITDA margin. You know, in an ideal case, they add up to 40 or more. I guess the question for you, Mike, is like, how important is it for Constellation to acquire Rule of 40 companies? And do you think other software acquirers overvalue, undervalue, or properly value when a company has hit that Rule of 40 threshold?
Yeah, well, of course, valuation is a heavily subjective matter for something that theoretically is highly numerical. You know, there's highly numeric, but let's start with the acquiring rule of 40 companies. I think we're obviously interested in acquiring businesses that have profitability and growth. But I would say it's not that important for us to acquire rule of 40 companies. I think our belief is we can help businesses to become, let's say, rule of 40 companies, right? Where they will continue to see growth and improved profitability over the years that we own them. So I would say, you know, it's not the entry point. It's always a goal for every enterprise. We believe strongly in after acquisition, strengthening the business so that it runs as a strong, profitable enterprise. And then focusing on from that solid foundation of strength, how do we continue to scale and grow the business? So, you know, I think we believe over time we'll get the businesses to something similar to how you would look at a rule of 40.
Mm-hmm.
As to, you know, are they overvalued, undervalued? In general, I would say we believe that taking a long-term view and thinking about businesses that you're going to hold for a long period of time, we're focused on trying to properly value a business with a very long-term perspective. You know, having been in many, many, many acquisitions over the years, you know, valuations are all over the map. So, yeah. You know, it's incredibly difficult to say, are they overvalued? Are they undervalued? I guess our focus has always been on, we bring forward what we believe is a very fair value for a business. We find like-minded individuals that share a similar view to us. And, you know, we win a reasonable number of deals. So I think our valuation approach makes sense. There, you know, you spend enough time in this marketplace and you talk to enough people, everyone will always bring forward, if they're in a sale process, the story of the friend that had the incredible exit for some huge multiple. That's not how it works for most enterprises. So why did they get the huge multiple? Was it overvalued? Was it undervalued? You know, you'd have to look at the details of the company that it was to see how it performed in the years following the acquisition.
I assume
I'm afraid I'm not really answering your question, Steve.
No, you are. I mean, to me, it sounds like, you know, rule of 40 is great, but it's not a prerequisite for you guys. And it sounds like you happily invest in companies that have yet to hit the rule of 40 benchmark, but you certainly see a path to that after you start to execute on your operational playbook. And I guess that one follow-up question I have to that is, how do you guys think about the weight of revenue growth versus profitability? Because, and this might have said more about like the ZERP era a couple of years ago than anything else, but I've seen private equity firms that put like a 2/3 rating on growth and a 1/3 rating on profitability. Others do a 50-50. How do you guys think about it generally if you don't look at it so formulaically?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're obviously trying to understand what is going to drive growth. So we're probably more interested in what are the driving factors behind growth than what is the exact level of growth in the business. So we're going to be asking ourselves, as someone that's going to own the business for decades, do we see a path to sustainable growth in the business? And that's going to be very important to us. So that's going to factor into our thinking. Again, as I said, I think the profitability of the business, you got to look at profitability over many years. So that profitability is far more within your control over the years that you own a particular enterprise. So I would say we probably look similar to private equity. We would value growth as an important metric for the long term of the business. And we would say if the profitability isn't at the level that it needs to be, you can certainly get it there over a period of time. So that's a manageable variable over the long term of a business. So probably prefer and value the growth aspect and would look at that as a meaningful sense of, how the business is going to perform.
Sure, that makes sense. I mean, for those prospective software acquirers with whom I work, it seems to me that many folks think that they almost have to acquire a Rule of 40 company, and if they find a Rule of 20 or a Rule of 30 company, it is somehow less attractive or something that, ought not to be executed on. But I often counsel those people that Rule of 40 companies do not grow on trees. Like, that is a very, very difficult benchmark to hit. I have no idea what this number is, and I'd actually be curious to hear your take on in terms of like the percentage of all small to medium-sized software companies that hit the Rule of 40. I have no clue, but I would totally guess it's less than 20%, if that. Do you have any sort of like anecdotal feedback
Yeah,
in
I
terms
mean,
of?
it would certainly be well below 50%. I don't know what the exact number would be, but I would agree with you. I think, what's probably more important, like again, for us, we want the people that are selling their businesses to Constellation to continue on the journey with us, right? So I would say what we're looking for is people that want to run a business that has the ability to get to a rule of, let's say 40, 35, some meaningful number. But really, what we're more interested in is knowing that the leaders are curious and they want to learn, right? Because, we have the fortunate position of owning many, many, many software businesses, and we're a very data-driven enterprise, which means that we'll be able to look at things that drive long-term success through many different lenses, by geography, by type of business, by size of business. And if you look at all that information, there's tremendous insights that we can bring to any CEO and the leadership team that they work for. So if the team is curious and open to learning and willing to try new things, that's going to be far more attractive to us than what is their current level of growth and profitability, because our belief would be, with our knowledge and with curious, humble, hungry individuals that want to learn, we can do great things together. So the starting point is just the starting point. It's where we're going to go on the journey together. That's probably far more important to us, and knowing that we have a team that really wants to take that journey with us.
This episode is brought to you by Oberly Risk Strategies. Now, some of you likely know Oberly is the insurance brokerage and insurance diligence provider for the search fund community and has been trusted by search investors, lenders, searchers, and CEOs for over a decade now. The company is led by August Felker, himself a two-time successful searcher, both within the funded and self-funded models. He personally runs Oberly's dedicated search fund practice that works with searchers across the entire diligence, purchase, and post-close process. Their due diligence offering, which is 100% free of charge, by the way, will assess the pros and cons of your target company's insurance program and will summarize any potential coverage gaps, the pro forma insurance pricing, and the program structure changes needed for closing. At or shortly after closing, they will then execute on all of those findings on your behalf. In 9 out of every 10 client engagements, they're able to either reduce spend or improve coverage, all in such a way that the searcher or CEO can focus on other things while Oberly handles all things insurance for them. Oberly has serviced over 900 customers across a decade of operation and has an NPS score that puts them at the top of their industry. But don't take my word for it. Click on the hyperlink located within the show notes or in today's episode description, and we will gladly put you in touch with as many happy Oberly customers as you'd like. How about the on-premise to SaaS investment thesis? I have, you know, many folks listening to this are looking for a software company that is likely 20 to 30 years old, sells one-time perpetual use licenses. The software is hosted on-premise. And their thesis is, hey, I'll buy one of those for maybe a high EBITDA multiple or a low revenue multiple. I'll convert that revenue stream to be recurring. I'll re-architect or rebuild the product to make it multi-tenant SaaS, and I'm going to make a whole bunch of money doing so. How common is that thesis for Constellation? And do you think there's still a sufficient number of targets available in the market for this to be a meaningful thesis for you guys?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of the number of targets that are out there, there are many, many software targets out there. So we think there's still a very large addressable market. I mean, the migration from on-premise to SaaS, again, that's all over the map. It really depends on what's the type of solution that we're talking about. So to me, what's probably more interesting than on-premise to SaaS is, if you have an on-prem system, do you need to move fully to a multi-tenanted solution? Not necessarily. And in many situations, maybe your customers wouldn't even want that. I think what they want to know is that the application that they're running is open, that it actually integrates well with other applications. So, you know, an on-premise solution with a solid API strategy could be quite fine for many, many years into the future. So we would obviously, like anyone, be interested in seeing what we can do to improve the level of recurring revenue that comes from those customers. But, you know, I guess my perspective would be, at the end of the day, most clients are interested in their solution. So what they want to know is their solution is a good solution, it's flexible, and it can take updates in a relatively simple fashion. So whether that's done on-premise or whether that's done SaaS, often in an ERP system, which many of our solutions are, there's still a heavy amount of custom development coding that goes on in that world, whether the client does it or whether we do it. So if you have a solid upgrade approach, whether I don't think the SaaS component is as critical as sometimes we in the software industry say that it is. So, you know, I think I would say, you know, to anyone that's out there that's trying to make the journey from on-premise to SaaS, that's just one of the items. And to the customer, it's really an investment philosophy more than a technical philosophy, right? And, you know, it's a question also of who's making the decision, right? And this is a pendulum that swings back and forth between, is it IT or is it the business? I'd say more and more the business is deciding what technology to acquire, not the IT department. And business people are not nearly as interested in the technical underpinnings of the application. And if they hold the purse strings, they'll sometimes buy a technically inferior solution because it actually maps well to meeting their business needs.
Right. So your stance on, hey, we shouldn't automatically assume that every on-premise business should be transitioned to SaaS, which I think is exactly right. I guess if I were a skeptical listener, I would push back and say, well, how much of that is rooted in your hold forever thesis? So asked another way, if you were running a software-focused private equity firm and you had to exit in 5, 6, or 7 years, would you think about that question differently? Because, someone has to be willing to buy it from you 5 to 7 years.
Yeah, I would say I probably would think about it differently, but not because of the underlying technology, but because of the story I need to sell to the next person that's going to take on the business. So I'm now talking about I've made all these investments. My technology is current, it's modern, it's many, many different things. And so, I've done the hard work. You should reward me in my valuation for all that I've done. What I would say is when we're thinking about things, we're thinking about it differently. This is a multi-year journey we're taking with clients. We're not here to maximize our exit value, right? We're not here to tell you we did these things over 3, 5, or 7 years, and as a result, we should be rewarded for all the work that we've done. Our belief is the clients are the ones that will truly determine the value of the application. So if we're doing our job properly, they're going to stay for a long period of time. And that is it's a totally different lens than a PE or another firm might be looking at it, which is trying to justify the things they've done over a finite period of time that are accreting value to the seller and are upside for the buyer.
Yeah, that makes total sense. I mean, hence the value in the hold forever strategy. You mentioned that there are plenty of targets that are currently on premise that are running healthy and vibrant companies. What about 5 to 10 years from now? As best as you can tell, pulling out your crystal ball, do you think there'll still be a healthy and robust market of on-premise companies to buy 5 to 10 years from now?
Well, I think there'll certainly be some. I think there'll be less, but then to your point, there'll be a whole bunch of newer entrants that have come in that didn't start in an on-premise world. It started in a SaaS world, right? They started with a different design. And I would say in 5 to 10 years' time, the dynamics of what the software enterprises look like are, they're going to be different. I don't know exactly how they're going to be different, but I would presume if there are less on-prem, there will be more SaaS style businesses that are out there. So there'll always be a market of businesses that you would think people would be able to acquire. But again, we don't have a crystal ball, right? We tend to focus on the opportunities that are currently in front of us and seeing if we can find enough businesses where we think we can make a meaningful difference to their future over the long term.
Makes sense. How does Constellation think about target companies that have a relatively high percentage of revenue coming from professional services? Like, I know the answer is it's very situationally dependent and very context dependent. So maybe just if we zoom out, like at a general level, I don't know, company A has 10% of revenue coming from services, company B has 40% of revenue coming from services. How do you guys think about that percentage? What might that mean to you, and how do you dig into whether that's a good, bad, or a neutral thing?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's funny when I was running a SaaS business, if you had professional services, it was like, oh my God, what's wrong with your product that
Yeah,
you
exactly.
need to offer professional services in order for your customers to use it? This is horrible, right? And I would say that when we look at professional services, first of all, I would say that's not true. I don't think that's a reflection at all on the software. It's a question about in any application that PS revenue could be coming from a lot of different things. Like when I was at IntelliResponse and we started creating professional services, our professional services was offered not because the customer couldn't do the work themselves using our application without making any changes, but often clients are very busy. And often clients want to use your solution for certain reasons and not for all reasons. And so what we could see was there was a gap in the usage of the application where if we created professional services really just to use the same product that they could do themselves, and we could feed them data and information about how their customers were engaging with the technology, they loved it. Because they didn't have to do the work and they could just get the answers. And really, what they wanted at the end of the day was the data to make more informed decisions about other parts of their business. They didn't necessarily want to do all the work. So I would say from that lesson, when I think about PS, what's important to me is to know that the customers value the professional services work, and that if you're providing professional services, it's high enough value that you can make a meaningful level of profitability from it. So if
Does
you can
it
run a profitable PS business, why wouldn't you like that business? Why wouldn't you want to say that there's value? So, you know, we're thinking about, we're looking at a PS business. We're saying, hey, do the customers like it? Do they value it? Can you make a decent profit off of it? And do customers keep coming back and asking for more PS? Because if they do, that probably means that we're providing a high value service. And while it's not as attractive as pure recurring revenue where you don't have to do work, there's still value in PS, right? And it's an indication, and it's another revenue stream that that definitely can attribute value. So I wouldn't say it's a bad thing. It's just less predictable than pure recurring revenue.
Does it tell you anything about switching costs, right? Like the quick soundbite is hard in is hard out, meaning that if it's expensive and time consuming and disruptive to install it, then it's equally time consuming and expensive and disruptive to get rid of it. Hence reason, you know, at times suggestive of high switching costs, which we like as buyers.
Yeah. So, I mean, I would say definitely it would be one of the indications of switching costs, right? If there is a lot of PS revenue that's attached to it. And again, it's a question of what is the PS revenue in support of? Is it to get the application live the first time? Is it to enhance or modify the application as, you know, regulations change, as other things in their business change? Or is this extra service work that's being done on top of the application to enable the customers to get more value out of the core application once it's actually already being used? You know, I think if you know that it's basically going towards value adding exercises, then, you know, you should feel that it's going to be sticky for multiple reasons. A, because it took time to get it up and running, but B, because the customer values what you're offering and they keep coming back to the well and spending money with you, which probably is another important indicator of the longevity of the application.
Yep, makes sense. So over the past year or two, probably since, I don't know, maybe like mid-2022, there's been an emerging thesis with respect to acquiring what are sometimes referred to as venture capital orphan companies. And these are otherwise healthy and growing companies, but they just aren't growing at the rates that are required of their VC backers. And as a result, no longer command the time and attention of those VC backers, hence the orphan terminology. Is this a thesis that Constellation is looking into in any meaningful way?
Sure. I mean, I would say we acquire businesses from private equity, from venture capital firms. And so that's always been, I guess, part of our investment philosophy. And certainly we find that, you know, we're often a great home for those types of businesses that haven't fully met the expectation of a venture capital firm or a private equity firm for many reasons. But let's say they haven't met the expectations. I would suggest that we're a more patient acquirer. And we understand that, you know, over the long term, when you're building a business for long term stability and growth, you're not necessarily always going to see those high levels of growth year after year after year, right? And predictable growth is something that we value highly. So if the business was on a rapid trajectory of growth at one point, and now it's not growing at that speed anymore, you know, I would say that we often do quite well in those situations because we're more patient, because we're not looking for an exit and we're going to own the business for a long time. So we continue to look at PE firms, VC firms. We look at the maturity of the funds, which businesses are still sitting there. Are funds being, you know, either rolled over or are they being sundowned and that fund is closing out? Those can sometimes be good places to find acquisition opportunities.
So if you guys have been exploring this thesis for a while, I guess the question is, has the thesis changed at all over the past couple of years, or has it grown in prominence over the past couple of years? And the reason why I ask is because I've just been hearing this a lot more over the past year or so than I did, you know, 3, 4, 5 years ago. And I think the basic thesis is that, you know, prompted by a decade of, you know, effectively zero interest rates, there's been a lot of fundraising. And in many instances, companies that probably never should have sought venture sought it anyways. And in many of these instances, especially over the past year or two, the value of the company is less than the stack of preferred equity in the capital structure, meaning that the founder is probably going to get nothing and, you know, likely wants to move on to other endeavors. So like, has this thesis grown in prominence over the past couple of years, or is it pretty steady over the past like 3, 4, 5 years?
Well, look, I think I would say the thesis has probably grown in prominence, largely for some of the reasons that you're mentioning. You know, in many enterprises quite a few years, for some of us, you know, quite a few years, we've seen debt at incredibly low levels. So the cost of capital of borrowing money to scale and grow your business was at extremely low rates. And so, you know, many enterprises wouldn't have thought twice about putting meaningful debt onto a business. In the current landscape, of course, we know globally, the cost of capital has gone up significantly. And that's causing businesses to have to reevaluate, you know, how much cash is this business generating? Can it afford to service its debt? And that's driving different decisions. Well, no question it's driving different decisions for lots of enterprises. So I think you're probably seeing a changing landscape in terms of businesses historically that would have had more time to adapt and adjust to changing market conditions. Now, with heavy debt servicing on their plate, some businesses are coming to market that may not have wanted to come to market were it not for the fact that, you know, they don't have as much cash available as they once had. So, yeah, I definitely think it's changing the landscape.
This is a very specific and technical question, but an important one nonetheless. And it has to do with the accounting treatment of software development costs. As you know, obviously, some companies will capitalize certain development costs to their balance sheet, while others will expense them as they are incurred. Does this accounting practice have any bearing at all on the valuation that you place on these types of companies? And if you could just explain to our listeners why or why not?
Sure. I think it does have an impact. So we would look at the capitalization of software as something which doesn't truly reflect the profitability of the enterprise, right? And as a result, when we look at businesses, we don't capitalize software development in any of the companies that we work with. So we would be reversing the effect of capitalization and looking at how much money was actually spent by the enterprise in each year to do R&D, right? To do their development costs, so that we're looking at the business as this is a true proxy for how much cash is the company able to generate on its own steam. Right. So we just normalize everything and say, look, whether a company capitalizes the software or it doesn't, when we're thinking about this business over the long term, we're asking ourselves, you know, how profitable can it be? How much cash can it generate? So, you know, capitalization is just an accounting methodology that is an acceptable accounting methodology, but it's not something that we would ever use to think about this is a way to run a software business. So we would, you know, essentially remove the cost of capitalization and look at the true cost of R&D and then say, is that a reasonable proxy for, you know, what the company will be able to do in terms of generating cash in the future?
Yeah, that makes sense to me. Capitalize, I mean, I know it's permitted under GAAP, but capitalizing R&D costs has always struck me as like a somehow legally permitted accounting sleight of hand.
Yeah. Well, I think what, as an operator, right, and growing up running multiple businesses, you know, there's always a day where you're going to pay for capitalization if you've done it. The minute you start to slow down your R&D spend and you've got a lot of capitalized software, you're going to start to see, oh, wow, I'm incurring a lot of development costs now, and I'm actually not doing that much in terms of active R&D. I think it's just good practice as an operator to look at how much money do I have? How much can I afford to actually spend on R&D? And so, yeah, I hear what you're saying about capitalization. I just think, you know, as an operator, you should always make sure that you have the money to fund what it is you're looking to do. And you should always be aware of how much money you actually spent, not what you put on your books in terms of the development costs, because that's a better way of thinking about, am I investing enough in R&D?
Yep, makes sense. I want to get on to two questions specific to the sellers of the companies, but before we
Sure.
get there, one final question that is a bit broader in nature. How does Constellation think about the valuation difference, if any, between a vertical market software company and a horizontal market software company? Is there, broadly speaking, a value difference, and why or why not?
Yeah, that's a, I mean, that's a good question. It's kind of a loaded question. I would say that, you know, we would think about the value similarly. What we value is how sticky is the solution, how committed are the clients to continuing to use the application over a period of time. I think many would argue, and we certainly believe that vertical market software businesses are a great place to be because if you do well in those market segments, the client values not only your technology, but your depth of understanding of their industry, right? And often, and I guess I've grown up in the world of vertical market software plays, having run a number of them myself, it's great when you compete against a horizontal market player for an ERP system many times because you have this incredible depth of knowledge. You've got an ERP application, you've got lots of capabilities, but you speak the same language as your customers because you know that market segment so well. And horizontal players typically can't go as deep as you can. So I would say we would believe that vertical market software businesses are good because you have a strong differentiated value prop. And, you know, if we buy a horizontal market business, we're different than a PE would be. Like when you're building your software company and you're out raising money, all in and every frigging conversation you get into with an investor is, tell me about the TAM, the total addressable market. How large is your TAM? How is it growing? What's the rate of growth in the TAM? But when you're running a business, it's all about how are you doing with your customers? Are your customers liking you? Are they continuing to buy more? Are you growing in those relationships? Are you winning some new logos? So when we're thinking about the value of an asset, whether it's a vertical or a horizontal, it's much more reflective of, tell me about the customers and how does the customer use your application? What does the customer think about? I would say in general, the marketplace probably still rewards horizontal market software plays earlier if they're in a fast-growing market and they're doing that. But, you know, we obviously strongly believe there's huge value in vertical market software businesses, and the strength of the relationships they can build will last for decades. And so that over the long term is very valuable. How the rest of the market sees it, I think they're growing to see the value in vertical market software businesses, but I'm guessing if you ran the numbers, you'd still find that others would still value a horizontal market play as having a larger TAM, and therefore, you know, if it's on a good growth trajectory, may be able to grow faster.
Makes total sense. I have two questions for you specific to the sellers. In my experience, sellers of businesses are notorious for understating their degree of involvement in the day-to-day operations of the company. If I believed every seller I spoke to, every private golf course in the world would have a 10-year waiting list, according to them. So, given this, how do you evaluate the extent of the key person risk that resides within a seller? How do you tease out just how operationally involved they are?
Yeah, so I mean, that's a fantastic question, right? And I think with sellers, you know, you can start to assess how actively involved they are in the business based on how many different hats they wear when they come into meetings. So with many founders, you know, you'll come in, you'll be meeting with them, and they'll be saying, "Oh, let me give you a demo of my software." And then they'll proceed to tell you how they're not a good salesperson, but they just have been demoing it for so long, whatever. And then you go over and you start asking things about product, and they'll say, "Oh, yeah, no, here's my head of development." And you'll get into a meeting and you'll notice that the head of development keeps getting talked over by the CEO. It's like, I think those would be good indicators that regardless of what the seller is telling you, they're probably much more involved in the business than what they say. So I'd say the behavior of the sellers through the sale process will indicate a lot about how involved they are. What I would say, though, is, we've acquired many businesses and we hold them for many years. So the transition of knowledge is a very manageable task that can be completed over a period of time. And even very active, let's call them sellers, hire good people into the enterprise. And good people in the enterprise in an organization like ours, where we share knowledge, where we have best practices, where we have all these capabilities, they will thrive. So if the seller, for whatever reason, decides they don't want to stay with the enterprise over a number of years, and they only want to stay for a year and then they want to exit, whatever their time frame is, we would argue that's very manageable, right? Because you can teach other smart, capable individuals in the enterprise how to run this business over a period of time. So it's a risk. You definitely want to manage the transition, but I don't think we lay awake at night thinking if this seller doesn't come, there's no way this business could run. So it's just a question of having the right strategy for a transition of leadership if it's going to happen.
Yep, makes sense. Let's talk about that scenario where the seller does not want to stay. You mentioned that you guys strongly prefer to partner with existing management, but Constellation Software has been around for a long time. Presumably, at some point, these folks want to retire.
Sure.
So I expect that you have placed many, many CEOs in your many, many different operating companies. I'm curious, over the years doing so, what have you learned about the success rates of placing technical CEOs versus non-technical CEOs at the helm of your companies? Is there any discernible difference between those two categories of leader?
Yeah, it's a there. I would say it's not about technical versus non-technical. It's more about willingness to learn versus believing you have all the answers. So, what the people that exceed in our organization, they really excel after acquisition, are those that are curious and open to learning. And those individuals do phenomenally well, right? They tend to move from a line management role into maybe a COO role, a CEO role. And then often, because we acquire so many businesses, we have people like myself that started out, overseeing a portfolio of businesses, and then the size of that portfolio just kept growing. So I would say it's not about technical versus non-technical. I think either can be quite successful in our world and have been. It's people that are data driven that want to learn and believe that they need to surround themselves with talented individuals, right? That they're not trying to be the one person in the enterprise that has all the answers. And I think that's more important. And so what I would say is, yeah, we've placed a lot of CEOs into businesses, but more often than not, the CEOs are individuals from within the enterprise. They're not people we hired from the outside and came in. So if a seller has a finite time frame where they want to leave at the time of acquisition, I would say that can be manageable. We would then want to understand, tell me about the rest of your team. We'll do assessments on the quality of the rest of the team and try and get a sense of, are there others in there that could do the role and are open to learning? And it's I'll tell you a funny story. One of the first acquisitions I ever did was of a business in Ireland. And it was two gentlemen. They were you know, in their late 50s. They had built this business up themselves. It's a company that they had carved out. They were both programmers at Guinness, making software for, you know, creating Guinness beer. And then they had left that business and they built it out. When we were in the conversation of acquiring, they were like, hey, you know, we think we might want to stay for a year. We don't think we want to stay that long. We asked them if there was a successor, and they said, well, there's this young guy. He's been doing sales. We think he could be a successor for the business. We're not sure. We haven't really developed him, but we can see what could happen. That individual turned out to be a brilliant CEO and has subsequently gone on and now runs a very large portfolio of businesses. You know, would he have had those opportunities? They might have succeeded the business to him if there hadn't been this transition with us coming in, but I don't think he would have gotten the level of development and his career might not have grown at the same speed. So, you know, I would say people that are open to learn will go very far in any enterprise, not just in our enterprise. I think we just provide a great platform for them to learn at speed.
Yep. Now, when you guys actually kind of get inside a company, so to speak, so the acquisition is closed, your management team is in place, and you're looking around and kind of finding out where all the bodies are buried, so to speak. Mm-hmm. When you first get inside of a business, are there some recurring changes or areas for improvement that you tend to see over and over and over again? Like, if there is such thing as low-hanging fruit in small software companies, where does that low-hanging fruit tend to reside?
So I'd say for sure, there's a couple things. Number one is pricing, for sure. Like, you know, and we both run software businesses and, you know, pricing is probably the hardest thing to get right. And pricing is often, and when you're running a smaller business, is unfortunately often a factor of cash flow. So if we're concerned that our cash flow is getting low in the enterprise and we have a customer that looks like they can make a quick decision, and if we think that might float some extra money into our bank account, which means we can make payroll or pay bonuses or throw the Christmas party or do whatever, we might give a much bigger discount than we would normally offer because, you know, time is money and we're like, hey, we need some cash. So I would say take that pattern as you continue to scale and grow your business. And most enterprises, you know, if you talk to them, they'll say, oh, we have a price book, but, you know, we just kind of guess it. Or we talked to the customer and we knew what their budget was, so we priced to their budget, kind of thing. So you'll find incredible pricing inconsistencies in almost every business you acquire. So going back and then assessing what is fair market value, what is the fair price, how do we look across the customers to what percentage of the clients are paying fairly for the use of the application, that would typically be one of the areas, I would say, that you find over and over again. The other thing I would say in general that you see, and I was certainly guilty of this in my years running different software businesses, particularly if you've got a group of investors, you know, everyone believes that the value comes from growth and new logo growth. So when you're scaling and growing a business, you're quite focused on who's the next new logo coming in. And when that new logo comes in, you want to have your best people on the project because you want to make sure it goes smoothly. And so again, fast forward 5 or 10 years, and you probably have a group of clients that were very meaningful to the company at one point in time who now question how important they are, question how much attention they get from management. And if you're going to own a business for forever, you need to be focused on creating long-term value and long-term relationships. So I'd say the other area that we would focus on is how do the existing customers feel? And if we paid more attention to them, would they like us more? Right? And it's fairly simple, but it's surprising how many times the existing customers are getting a very, a very uneven experience, or depending on who you are, depending on how you work with the enterprise, similar customers could have two very different experiences. If you want to create long-term value over many years, every client should have a great experience, right? So how do you create great experiences for every customer?
How does that manifest? Is that more investments in customer support? Is it investments in like account management and farming on the sales side? Like what form does that typically take?
Yeah, it could be either of those. The form it typically takes is you go out and you talk to the customers first and say, you know, what's it been like working with us? Where are your sources of frustration? Tell me what a great client experience looks like in your opinion. Who would give you that type of an experience? So you try and identify the areas where there's frustration or friction and say, if we remove this frustration or friction, would you be happier? Would you be wanting to stay with us longer? Would you be willing to pay us more money, right? Any of those various items. Often it is more in the customer support area. It'll be in a situation where, you know, we can make it very hard for our customers to work with us. And often for the people that are calling into the support desk, right? They're calling in, they have a problem. They don't understand how the application runs. They don't know, is this common code, isn't it? They get on the phone with customer care and customer care says, oh, that's actually not a bug. That would be an enhancement. You're gonna have to pay us money if you want us to fix that and, you know, whatever. And so the client's frustrated because the software doesn't do what it wants. They don't understand how to go and find money in their enterprise. So if you could come up with a streamlined, you know, customer care program that took all that friction out and said, hey, we can, you know, we can make this a seamless, easy to work with experience, and we're going to not ask you for money every time you pick up the phone, odds are that you could just restructure your customer care and you could probably make much happier customers, even if they're paying you more money for the experience, because they just don't like being hassled for cash every time they pick up the phone. Right.
Yeah.
I'm just giving that as an example. So it comes down to understanding where the pain is in the existing customer relationships and then figuring out what the solution is. And it could be account management, it could be customer care, could be that your product is so buggy that, you know, your testing is really inadequate. You're rolling out your releases far too early. So it could be that you need to spend more money on testing, right? And on the core application. So, but the answer will be different in every situation, but it begins and ends with, let's talk to the customers first and see what their reality is. They'll give you the clues on where you're either over or under investing.
What about product management? Where do you see that in terms of low-hanging fruit? If you would call that low-hanging fruit post-acquisition, because my experience investing in software companies is that it is often the founder who decides what they're going to build, and then the developers just go build it. And there's very little process, business case analysis, et cetera, in deciding what we are going to build and why. My experience is like product management as a discipline, like almost doesn't exist in 90% of the software companies that I look at. How do you guys think about that? Do you think about that as low hanging fruit, or at least like a competency that needs to be built up in these companies on average?
I think it's a competency that needs to be built up in the companies on average, to your point. I think there's a certain point in the evolution of a business where you're talking to so many customers so frequently that whether that be the CEO or the head of product or the head of sales, you can kind of see those trends. You can figure out, hey, I've had five people ask for this. I'm pretty sure that should go in the base product. But again, if you look over a longer period of time and you're talking to only a subset of your customers as you continue to scale and grow, it becomes far riskier if you're making your decisions based on anecdotal stories you're hearing from a subset of your customers. And that's where you can sometimes see product development going awry. The features are being built that satisfy the needs of a small subset of the customers, and maybe they're incredibly complex things, right? So you've got three customers that would actually benefit from it, but the rest of the customer base would be confused as heck as to what is this thing, why is it in there, and am I paying for this, right? So product management is an area that you need to think hard about as you continue to scale and grow the business. And I would argue that you're right. For most of the enterprises, that's not an area that they do well. I don't know that it's low-hanging fruit only because, you know, being disciplined in your product management area is hard work and it takes time. But again, it's going to come back to, are you talking to your customers first? Do you understand where your customers are coming from? And are you talking to a good representative base of your customers, not either the ones that call all the time and scream the loudest, or those that are so nice to you that you always do the right thing for them just because they're such nice people to work with, right? You've got to make sure what you're building is reflective of the majority of your customers, not the minority.
Mike, it's been such a treat talking to you today and to get underneath the hood of an organization as revered as Constellation Software is. I should have bought the stock 10 years ago, but alas, it's the one that got away, I guess, among others. Anything that we didn't cover in today's conversation that you think we ought to have covered, or any thoughts or lessons or questions that you'd like to leave for folks listening to this?
Yeah, I mean, I think we covered a lot of ground, Steve. So I don't think there's really a lot that hasn't been said. I guess what I would say is, you know, I've been in the business of acquiring software businesses now for sort of the last 15 years. And if people are thinking about buying software companies, you know, I would just say, take your time, ask lots of questions, do the diligence, and make sure that you don't fall in love with the business before you've looked at everything around it, you know, and I think a lot of times it's easy to become enamored with the application. You look at the product, you look at management, whatever. I think being disciplined and looking at all elements of the business will pay meaningful rewards over a longer period of time. And, you know, I think the buy and hold mindset is a wonderfully rewarding mindset, right? It's incredible to have the ability. I've been fortunate to be here for over a decade now, so I can think of some of my earliest acquisitions that were done more than a decade ago and see those individuals just flourishing inside the enterprise in much, much larger roles than they ever would have been able to do. That's an incredibly rewarding thing to have been a part of. And, you know, that time is your friend. And if you are thoughtful about the choices you make, time typically ends up working in your favor. Time goes against you when you rush or when you don't pay attention to all the clients you're servicing. And if you've gotten to be a really large business and you have so many different customers, just think about ways where you could segment your customer base so that you could be closer to them and the clients would feel more like they have something in common with the other customers, right? And over that period of time, you're going to drive meaningful returns for yourself and for your shareholders. And I think you're probably going to have a great group of individuals that love working in the software business that you own.